Professor, the possibility of successfully navigating an asteroid field is approximately 3,720 to 1.
Never tell me the odds.
I'm Pete Mitchell. He's Peyton Jones. And this is the Church Planner Podcast.
Welcome back to the Church Planner Podcast. This is Peyton Jones, and I am joined today by three guests. I am with Tom, John, and Esther. Good to have you guys here.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
Thank you.
Well, I am really excited for this talk. It's been a long time coming. It took a long time for us to get this off the ground and scheduled, and I'm sure it's going to be worth the wait. We are talking with Sexaholics Anonymous members tonight, and it's really important for all of us at the outset to understand that the shame is what keeps people from even talking about this. So I want to thank each one of these guests coming on, because they are on here to help anyone and everyone who's listening, because it's a problem that affects everyone if everyone's honest, right? There's those who have struggled with this, and two types of people, those who have struggled with this and those who lie about it. So let's go ahead and get into it. First off, we don't have we could probably talk for hours about this, but I want to give each one of you a chance to kind of talk and tell your story. But first off, John, tell us a little bit about Sexaholics Anonymous.
Well, Sexaholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who, you really threw me off there. Are trying to get better from sexual addiction. And most of us have been struggling with this most of our lives, a lot of times in secret. And we feel a lot of guilt, shame, remorse. And a lot of times, all of us, we were ever told was just pray more, go to church more, just get involved more, and you won't have time to sin. And guess what? I made time to sin. I was a missionary. And I acted out overseas. So had I known about SA, I would have went there, because it's been around since the late 70s. So it was started actually by a man named Roy Kay, and he was a pastor at one point, a youth pastor up in Pasadena.
Yeah.
He had a very strong religious background, went to seminary, and his book, his story is in our white book. We use a plain white book for obvious reasons. And he shares about what lust, because our problem is not sex. Our problem is lust. That's the driving force behind our sexual acting out.
Mm-hmm.
And it shows how, where he started innocently looking at comics back in the late 30s, and how it just progressed. Because this is a progressive disease, just like alcoholism or crystal meth. It gets worse, never better. Mm-hmm. And in the late, after he's been through the mill, he'd read an article in a 1974 issue, I believe it was Time Magazine, calling the new addiction. So he started going to AA meetings, even though he wasn't an alcoholic, but he identified as one. And he then in the late 70s, he started SA, said there's got to be a fellowship for people struggling with this as well, because he knew he wasn't the only one. And what do they say? The 70s was the hangover after the 60s. That's what they call it. Because I'm also the son of a sexaholic, untreated sexaholic. So, it's a place that it's based on the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. We use AA literature as well as SA literature. And we work the steps. We get sponsors. Men sponsor men. Women sponsor women. And we try and do panels like this to carry the message, just like Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson did in the early 30s, trying to reach people for AA.
Yeah. I mean, it's really amazing to me. I'm fascinated by the fact that it was started by a pastor, and I'm actually really proud of that, because AA, I mean, I worked as a rehab nurse back when I was an RN. Looked amazing. In a skirt, but the reality is I was an RN on a rehab wing of a psychiatric hospital for a little bit, and you know, it really impacted me how powerful those 12 steps were and how much they were just based on the gospel. I mean, that that really stood out to me. And just knowing the history of Dr. Bob and why he founded it. And then when they took, they said, you know, we've got to kind of neuter it a little bit so we can reach more people. And pretty amazing stuff. So that's amazing. Well, who wants to tell their story first here?
Don't all volunteer at once. I guess I can. I'm P here, recovering sexaholic. I can just say that I have been sexually sober since 2024, January 2024. I don't think it's been mentioned yet. Our sobriety definition is no sex with self and no sex outside of a marriage between a man and a woman. For me, gosh, so I didn't actually grow up in any faith tradition. I had been to church maybe like a handful of times, just being invited by friends, but for the most part, it was just me, my mom, my dad, and my sister. And I didn't have the best relationships with my parents or my sister. It was very rebellious. It was a huge bully to my sister growing up, which was really, I think, a part of the disease. Not really having a ton of, adult supervision or like, people I looked up to in my life. I became sexually active when I was around 11. And that was, with other, you know, other sixth graders, like myself. And I didn't really know what I was doing. I was kind of just, I was also new. I had just moved from another town and I was trying to make friends. And this seemed to be like what everybody was doing. And so I kind of just adopted, for lack of a better word, kind of got involved in like hookup culture. All that to say, like, I didn't know what sex with self was. I was just kind of doing this because other people were doing it and I wanted to have friends. By the time I reached age 13, 14, then I discovered sex with self and pornography. And that kind of put fuel to the flames. During this time, I mean, gosh, I was drinking alcohol, smoking pot. At one point I did mushrooms, believe it or not, as a teenager. And I just kind of got fell into that. I wasn't really involved like in any like after school activities or didn't like have any sports or obviously no church community. And that pretty much continued up until I was 19 around 19. And you know, like I had girlfriends along the way and was sexually active with them. And from what I could see, like, you know, everybody's watching porn and doing what I did. So I didn't really see a problem with it. Not that like I had anybody in my life to really tell me otherwise. I would say I was pretty much a victim of the culture, I think is the best way to put it. Around age 19, I started to kind of feel the effects of specifically pornography. My volleyball coach noticed that like my performance, I wasn't playing as well as I could. And there was like a class that I felt that I should have gotten an A in, that I got a B in. I had like this feeling like, okay, something is wrong. And like porn is not good. But like, I've never even spoken to this with anyone ever. And I don't know what to do. I just know that I have a problem. And that basically continued up until I was 21. And I had a girlfriend at the time who, for you know, however, whatever reason, I stopped watching porn for. I shouldn't say for whatever reason. I was able to somehow, like, I don't know, with probably God's help, but at that time, you know, I thought it was just willpower. And she was actually kind of like a light in the darkness. She talked to me about porn, and I was in agreement with her, like, yeah, this is a problem. But even then, I didn't have the lust concept. So, you know, still sexually active in other ways, still having sex with myself, probably, I don't know, around on a daily basis. We eventually broke up, and I saw a psychologist because I wanted to get help with this. And this was just kind of, you know, some psychologist that you saw on any regular old insurance plan. And he didn't really think it was an issue. And he kind of like deflected it and was more interested in talking about problems with my girlfriend than like porn usage and just, you know, being so sexually active. During this time, I started having just a ton of health issues. I started having, I had to quit volleyball because I had a hurt knee, and I started having hand issues. I got what's called radial tunnel syndrome, similar to carpal tunnel syndrome, but closer to the elbow than the hand. And I didn't know what was going on. I just knew that I was in a ton of pain, and I had done, like, you know, I've been overactive, playing musical instruments, cello, guitar, piano, stuff like that. That was definitely a factor, but basically life just got really hard. And I got really depressed, and it was during the year that I was transferring to a university to finish my degree. And I basically had to take the whole year off because I couldn't, I was medically unable to like write and type because of my hand issue. And from there, I got really, really depressed. And I've always been prone to depression. I got diagnosed with cyclothymia later in recovery, which was super insightful. But at this point, like, I don't know what's going on. I'm sad all the time. My body's failing. I'm addicted to this porn. And I'm really lonely because, you know, everybody's transferring to school and I'm stuck at home. I got to a point of despair, in life where I like just didn't really see, what was worth living for. But you know, God's funny, cause in that, basically I had this, knee surgery, and, after the surgery, I basically just felt the Holy Spirit's prompting and was able to just stop sexually acting out for about a year. And, you know, in SA, we call it our spiritual experience. In the church, you call it regeneration. I got really involved, reading, the Bible. I was just doing this all on my own. I didn't have like there's no like evangelist. This was just kind of like a thought, like, huh, maybe you should read that thing. And maybe you should stop. So I started praying and fasting. I do like these 3-day fasts, like week fasts. And like, I don't even know what I'm doing. It's just like, feels really good. And I go to a church and I get saved, and I get into recovery. They had like a Pure Desire, which is a great, great group. Totally recommend that. But I was in that. And it ended because I went down to college and got involved in SA, which I'm in now. I never really realized how like lonely I was in the disease, because I never really had like a community to kind of like reference my experiences to. I was always just, you know, I had friends, and, you know, we'd be partying or playing sports or skateboarding or whatever. And like, you know, those were good times, but never anybody to really share my inner world with. And when I got into recovery, finally, like, people wanted to hear like, oh, okay. Like, you know, like, how are you feeling? Like, are you sad? Are you angry? And like, this is like a way of life. Like, we call each other on the daily, and we go to group every week, and we talk about, like the struggle against sin. And for me in recovery, like, I've definitely done God's done a huge work in my heart and in forgiveness, because I've discovered when I got into SA that I was a very resentful person. That took a long time to I didn't realize, like, to me, it wasn't an option that I could just like love people even if I thought they were wrong. Like, I could still ask for their blessing. I could still ask for the thing that I wanted for them, even if like they were doing something that was wrong or that made me angry. And that, I think, was the biggest breakthrough in SA for me. And it's like, as far as like the depression goes, when I got into SA, that completely went away. And I can only really attribute it to, like, you know, making 2 hours of calls a day, or, you know, going to a couple of meetings a week and really just being super connected in the community. And like, I got recommended to be put on, like antidepressant medication and like antipsychotics and all that. And yeah, maybe that would have done something, but I'm really glad that, like, SA is my solution for that. I think with that, all that.
Well, that's, I mean, thanks for sharing that story. It's, I think people relate to so many, you know, different parts of the story. And I know that telling your story is a big part of SA, kind of like AA. This is one of the things I love about church planners, because when you're an established church, right, the culture is maybe like, you know, been set for the last 100-150 years. Whereas when you're planting a church, you get to create that culture from scratch, right? You get to kind of create a core team. And one of the things that I think is, you know, it says in Hebrews, you know, no other foundation can be laid than grace, right? Like, than that of grace. Or Christ, as Paul says that at one point. And I think, you know, when you have grace as the foundation, people feel that when they come in. And I often say to the church plant, we're in this core team development up in North County, San Diego, and I will sometimes introduce myself as, "Hi, I'm Peyton. I'm a recovering sinaholic." And, you know, which comes from the you know, AASA, because it's the leveler, right? Like, we are all on a level playing field. It doesn't matter what your sin is, you pick your poison, but we all need Jesus. And I find that so cool, you know, like when you go into, because like I said, when I worked rehab and recovery, it's the leveler. I mean, it really is. And so I know a lot of pastors are in SA. This is one of the things when John and I first talked about this podcast, I talked to him and I said, "Well, you know, I mean, how many?" He goes, "Oh, there's lots of pastors in SA." And that was where I was like, all right, we for sure have to get you guys on this podcast and chat about this, because somewhere, somehow, those pastors had the guts to get the help they need. And that's so important. You know, I really thank God that you guys are doing God's work, you know. So, Esther, would you mind sharing your story?
Absolutely. Hi, I'm Esther. I'm a lust and sexaholic, and I'm very grateful to be here. So just a little bit about me. I'm going to go through my childhood. I was born into a chaotic Christian family. I knew I was loved by both my parents, but it seemed conditional and kind of based on behavior, good behavior, I should say. Mm-hmm. And that also formed my understanding of God. I also had to deal with early childhood trauma. I suffered physical abuse, and also sexual addiction was in my home. My dad is and was a lustaholic as well. My older brother was extremely physically abusive. He's about 14 and a half years older than me, and he would often threaten to kill me, and was truly just angry at my parents for having another child and bringing him into this chaotic home. My older sisters would sometimes get hit for me, hide me in cabinets to make sure he wouldn't get me. And then my parents were just so conflicted in their own dysfunctional cycle, they often were oblivious to our emotional needs and would leave us with this angry abuser. My mother could have benefited from our sister program called S-Anon. She also wrestled with her own demons of depression and alcoholism, and just picking up the slack for the sexaholic, my father. We saw a lot in the home as children, and when it was discussed, which really meant like a confession of what was already known that was happening, then there was an apology, and it was supposed to be over. And rather, we should all be good Christians And we were reminded and told to forgive and forget, especially if there is a tearful apology. So at 18, I made an inner vow to never be like my mother and put up with a cheater. And I remember saying I would cheat before I was ever cheated on. And at 18, I did exactly that to get out of a toxic relationship. But that just started a new cycle of an on-again, off-again relationship modeled by my own parents. And then one guy was not enough. If I couldn't get all their attention, this is where lust really comes in. I had to be continually in a dating relationship. I had a reprieve when I married my husband, and we had children, and life was busy, and I was busy in the church. But guess what? He was not perfect either. And so I started to compare him to other men, and then I started to fantasize about other men, and lust took over, and I was lusted after. And that was a real high. My eyes were opened. And all those unresolved issues now erupted like a volcano. And then reality hit. I am like my cheating father with kids at home. I had my first affair, which was just a cycle of lying and more affairs, each time thinking this is what I needed, or I deserve this, or this one will make me whole. But of course, my life was out of control with more and more affairs, lies, pain, brokenness, that nearly ruined me, my husband, and my children. I can tell you that in those early years, I experienced the detriment of this progressive disease because it has been said of sin, and that's kind of what addiction is, that sin will keep you longer than you plan on staying and take you farther than you ever wanted to go.
Mm.
And I learned to be a better liar, manipulator, learned other nasty behaviors like wearing a mask in church and just living a double life. The black hole in me and lust addiction was always longed for more. It could never be quenched. It could never be filled for me or anyone in my circles. Lust always wants more and needs more because addiction only takes and never gives back. So something had to change. In fact, it took a drastic change, but not until I had to surrender and stop trying to manage this addiction and my behavior.
Hmm.
36 months ago, this month, I had a major relapse, and it brought me back to SA after an 11-year hiatus. I swore I would never go back to SA because I had been confronted by some women in the program for continually acting out, and I blamed them for calling me out.
Hmm.
But 6 years ago, I went to a 4-day Christian intensive, Healing for Women, a workshop in Nashville, and they suggested SA, but I held my ground. Oh, no way. Give me one of those other S programs, I said, and I went to those. But I was waiting for a second court date to get a divorce from my relationship. And it never happened. That's just another God story. Remarkably, I was able to get back with my husband without divorcing and ended my affair. But I was truly only technically sober because I still allowed contact with the affair partner. So we're going backwards a little bit in 2020. And then I moved back in and I had technical sobriety until 2023. My affair partner came back into town. And I hooked up with them. And it took that realization of powerlessness over this addiction. Mm. I ran back to SA. And then again, I went to a different intensive and started 90 meetings in 90 days.
Mm.
So going back to 2020, what happened was because I believe what we say is our higher power, or in my case, God through Jesus, was always working. And I knew I needed SA, and so did God. So when I went back to that workshop later in that year in 2020, I asked for a sponsor. I said, you guys need to help me find a sponsor. And they said, okay. And I had these three requirements. And God, like, check, 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 all of them. And it was kind of remarkable. But that, again, is another God story. And as the white book says, half measures availed us nothing because I said I was only technically sober. And I would soon find out what that meant the hard way, like a good sex addict. The semi-work did make me feel, or at least give the impression, that I was making progress. There is some truth to faking it until you make it, but that's another story. So after 2 years of technical sobriety, but without dedicated recovery, and I certainly was not surrendered, I relapsed. I had a week bender with my ex-affair partner, and I could manage seeing him, or so I thought. But then reality hit. I realized I could not stop myself when I wanted to, and I did not because I could not. I was, as they say, powerless over lust, and felt everything I had been reading in the literature. Fast forward to 2023, and I came back to my first in-person SA meeting. A room full of men addicts, but this time I knew what was necessary. I needed this room, and so I started SA, seriously ready to stop playing around with the steps, finish my step one in a few months. And after it had taken me years to just answer those questions, I was able to share it in a few months. At 364 sober days, I said I was so grateful to be here. See, I didn't want to identify with SA, certainly as a woman, sexaholic. I did not ever think I would be grateful to be in those meetings. I saw it as a necessary path because nothing else was working. But I am without a doubt very blessed in my sexaholic meetings. In the process, I have learned to be healthy with my brothers in SA as well as with other men professionally. I no longer objectify them. The white book says our God is patient and loving and kind with us, as we must learn to be with others. So I'm walking through this program with sponsees now. They're blessings in my life. I have reconnected with the other women from SA. Remember the one that I told you confronted me? She's one of my biggest cheerleaders. She just took her like 15-year chip. Wow. And that was pretty emotional for me to be able to give it to her. Wow. Those are just gifts of this program. Some things that work for me, they say it works if you work it. It's calling others, working with a sponsor, praying, spiritual reading, meetings, meetings, and meetings. Giving back what I've received. I now facilitate with other recovery groups for women. And I'm so grateful to still be in this program and working with others. Because of God using SA, my life is still being restored through recovery. The white book says, staying sober is our initial objective. A spiritual awakening is the unintended result. My first year of recovery at a women's retreat, I asked for a double portion of God's anointing. I was rebaptized the next week by my husband, and then I shared my testimony a few months later with women in a retreat. My friend from Rigsy Music wrote a song based on my story called Daughter, and it's about my life. So I am a co-songwriter, and that has allowed me another platform. I remember thinking in 2023, how could God ever use me after so much failure? But he continues to use my story for his glory, to bring others like me, a prodigal, back to him. He gives hope to those that come into our rooms because they realize they're not alone. And so I've gone back to the ministries that helped me, and I'm now able to share with more women in recovery. My marriage is celebrating 35 years. My relationship with my kids is thriving as I make a living amends. And we had two new grandbabies born this past year. Wow. My church family has embraced me, seeing the change and accepting God's miracles. So many gifts from working the steps and being in this fellowship. Thank you for letting me share my story and share about SA in my life.
Well, thank you. That is, wow. It's just so humbling, you guys, to two things. One, to hear just, you know, the story of redemption, and, you know, number two, just, you know, the courage that you guys, I'm sure in some cases, you'd rather not tell your stories in some ways, but then this helps people. Like, I know my listeners out there, if they're not thinking of themselves, they're thinking, well, I mean, okay, like as pastors, right? Someone comes to you and says, Pastor, I got a problem with porn. What do you tell them? I mean, just don't do it. You know, I mean, I love this, you guys. And, you know, you mentioned how, like, I couldn't stop and the fact it's a disease. It's funny how Christians are kind of ignorant about this, right? There's a book for all of you listening who are like, hey, I don't understand. I don't believe it's a disease. If you get a chance, pick up a book by Norman Doidge. It's called The Brain That Changes Itself. He was a pioneer in neuroelasticity. He's got an entire chapter in that book on what porn does to your brain. And with any addiction, it eventually codes a protein on your DNA, which is passed down to generations. So when people say things like, oh, I don't believe it's a disease, the reason it's a disease is because not only does it act like a disease, but there is a genetic thing that is passed down that they can now demonstrate via science that any trauma encodes proteins, and addictions are a type of trauma, and it encodes the protein on your DNA. So some people, they're walking with a limp as they begin because of their genetic predisposition. And we do believe that as Christians anyways, right? Did we not inherit sin anyways? So why would Christians even have a hard time with that concept? Maybe we're just starting to uncover some of the science of what the Bible talks about. So just really appreciate your story, you guys, and just your boldness. And you guys tonight, like, you're my heroes. This is awesome. So, all right, last, John, time for your story, brother.
Last but not least.
I was going to make that joke, but hey, you stole my line.
There we go. Well, I am a product of the 60s and 70s. You know, like I mentioned earlier, right? One of the things, I grew up in a house where a lot of us, and you'll hear it in a lot of 12-step programs, especially ACA, where it says there was a couple rules in our houses, like, we're not to feel, we don't talk, we don't trust, and we don't feel. And that's what it was. We knew what was going on, but you don't talk about it, no matter how bad it is. And so my dad is also, he's in his, I think he's 86, 87. He's still an untreated sexaholic. But he's the one that brought porn into the home in the 70s. And he would leave it on his nightstand like it was a Time or Newsweek magazine. And us kids can easily get to it when they were at work. So that's where I got my first exposure, was from my own father. And then he started bringing stuff for my mom, because it was the 70s. You got to spice up the marriage, you know. So he's bringing Playgirl for her, and he's looking at Playboy. And I know all the titles of his, because they got worse, progressively worse, the titles of those magazines. And he was having affairs on my mom. And he had also beaten me, you know, to a point where I had to wear a sling to school one day, and we didn't talk about it. I didn't even go to the hospital for it. And so I guess that I just didn't want anything to do with my father at that point. And so after my mom got tired of all of his I'm sorries, she threw him out. She divorced him. But then what do you think she finds? She finds an alcoholic at a bar and brings him into the house. But so my supply of porn dried up. So I knew what my dad used to look at, and I wasn't old enough, but I can at least go to like those news racks, put 50 cents in and get in. He used to get these sex newspapers with stories and personal ads, kind of like Craigslist today. And some of the stories actually fueled my head more than pictures, because it's all fantasy. Because one of the things in this program, I'm addicted to fantasy. Yeah, because I can control it somewhat. And so I started looking at that. And one of the things I forgot to mention earlier was that I was also molested by my older half-brother when I was about 4 or 5. And so, and some neighborhood kids. So other boys. And so certain things start setting in motion, you know, for me. And as I grew, when I was a teenager in high school, I think it was my last year in high school, my mom would spend time with this alcoholic boyfriend at his place. And she said, you could drive my car. So we didn't have internet in the 80s, as you might remember, Peyton. But so I found something. I looked at something called the Yellow Pages. And I looked up adult bookstore. And you know what? If I look for something, I'm going to find it. So I found one. And I went to one. I was it was like a candy store. So I started going there and looking at and I thought, oh, this is great. I can get whatever I want as long as they didn't card me so I can get stuff I wanted. And I thought that was great. But then I act out with myself to that, throw it away. And then I feel guilt, shame, and remorse and said, I'll never do that again. And come weeks or months later, I go, you know, the compulsion struck again and I have to go back again. And I was doing that. And then I discovered something called video arcades within adult bookstores. You just put 25 cents in at the time and then you can watch a movie for a couple minutes. And then one day I got a knock on one of my door that one of those viewing booths. And it was another man. I said, I'm not going to do that. But like anything else, every line I drew in the sand said I wouldn't cross, I crossed. So I started having anonymous sex with other men. And then I said, I'm not gay. I don't know what's going on here. And I always felt, I just felt a lot of confusion. And then I went to college. I'd just become a Christian in high school. And then I started going to, I got involved with Campus Crusade for Christ on my college campus. And I said, okay, I started getting discipled and going to church. And I said, okay, this is what I needed to fix me. And I was good for about 6 months. And then in the spring of 1983, then the compulsion struck. And I started back on my, you know, visiting adult bookstores on a regular basis, acting out with other men. And always feeling guilt and shame, cutting classes, so my grades suffered. And then I went on a couple short-term summer missions trips, one with Campus Crusade and one with another organization. And I said, maybe this will help, you know, doing some full-time Christian work. And in 1987, I applied and got accepted with a mission organization in Illinois. They were called International Teams at the time. Now they're One Collective. So I went with them, spent 3.5 years in the Philippines. But while I was there, I had to take a couple of psychological tests. One was the MMPI test. You may be familiar with that. And the Briggs-Myers. And then I had to meet with some psychologists from Wheaton College. And of course, being the good sex addict I am, I told them anything they wanted to hear. Because if I told them, yeah, I struggled this way, they would have probably said, you know what, you need to go home, get some help. And I quit my job. I was commissioned by my church. And I said, I look like a failure. I can't do that. So, and that was my ego and pride at work. And so I went, spent 3 years, but while I was there, even if I'm halfway around the world, lust is with me. So I ended up acting out eventually with being homesick. I acted out with two different Filipino men. One was within our missions agency and one was outside of it. I only confessed to one because I didn't want the one that was in our missions agency to get in trouble. And then they sent me to counseling. And of course, I had to let my church, home church know, the mission agency know. And I said, okay. So I went to counseling and I thought, okay, this is good. Maybe this is what I needed to fix me. So I went there and it helped for a while. And I was white. What we call, there's a term we call in the 12-step program, white knuckling. I was white knuckling, trying to do it on my own strength and power. And after 3.5 years, I came home and the compulsion struck. It was easier to find stuff here than over there. So I went back looking for adult bookstores and some of the places I went were closed because of neighborhood gentrification. But I ended up, but if I looked hard enough, I could find it. And I did find stuff and then got into phone sex later on. And a few years later, I was part of a singles group at church. And I remember I was fired from a job. And I was looking for work, and I went on a 3-day binge of phone sex, acting out with myself, magazines. And then I ran into a guy from my singles group, and I told him, you know, I'm struggling with this problem. And he says, you know, I belong to this program called SA. Would you be interested in coming to a meeting with me? I said, yes. I was desperate at that point because I couldn't keep going the way I was. So I went with him on December 4th, 1995. So that was my first meeting. And I heard the room had about like 20, 30 people in it, men and women. And I was hearing stories of our acting out was different, but the commonality was we were all struggling with lust. That was our problem. And when they said no sex with self or anyone else except spouse, meaning a man and a woman, I said, okay, fine, I'll do that. So I've been on that program since then, and I've had great bouts of sobriety and some not so great. You know, I eventually, you know, at one point I had, and it was around the time we had Refuge Church here in Long Beach. I was involved with another man at the time. And I think I told you and your mentor from Scotland at that coffee house one day, just pouring out my heart. And after that, about a year or two later, I remember just praying, God, please break this up. And he did. He went up north and I stayed here, and I actually got better because I was what they call in the program. I was half measuring it, trying to do the program, trying to do church and trying to be in the relationship. It just didn't work. And I even stopped drinking because drinking was leading me to act out as well. Made it easier when my inhibitions are there. You know, I could have, it was like one martini, two martini, three martini, four. And that was me. So, but this program works when I work it. And you know what? What I used to think was a liability in me, because I used to feel so shameful, because I said, I used to think my form of acting out was the lowest. And I'm like, no, it wasn't, because it's like there's an old timer, he has like maybe 40 years in our program. He said something like, it's just another flavor of lust. That's what it is. Like 31 flavors. Everyone has their own flavor. And that happens to be my flavor. But since then, my lust for men has dropped like a rock. I really have that desire has really gone away. And so now I'm able to work with I'm helping two Muslims in Saudi Arabia right now that are same-sex attracted. Help them. I'm sponsoring one of them, but his friend wants help. And I can see how God is using me in that area as well. So
that's so cool. And that, you know, I mean, having a front row seat, I'll never forget that day. I remember that very well, being in Long Beach, and you were just like, hey, can I meet with you guys? And I remember again, the same thing. I just was like, wow, that took a lot of trust for you and courage to just come to your pastor and say, hey, I kind of think I know you. I kind of think I picked up like from watching you, because that takes a huge amount of trust. If somebody's going to come to you with this, that, you know, you don't know what you're going to get, but I do remember that desperation that was in you. And, you know, there is that, somebody once called that walk with Jesus, you know, it's the long defeat. And I think, Esther, some of your story was that God was always there. He was always working. And all of us have our own struggles and journeys that I just love the fact that there's somewhere like SA where people can get help. And I think, you know, I've learned just here tonight, the term sex with self, that is also a piece of it. Like, that's cool. It's not just looking at porn and sleeping with other people. Like, that's pretty cool, you guys. It's pretty neat. I'm actually learning a lot being on here. One of the things that I would ask is, you know, church planters are always wanting to help the people in their communities. How widespread is SA? Would you say like every city in America, every major city, like how vast is the network? If a church planter went into a city, is there a good chance that they could stick their arm out and there'd be an SA pretty close? Or are you still opening chapters all over America? Is it an oscillating universe? Or how does the network work of SA?
I can answer that. There are areas where it's more prevalent, areas where it's less prevalent. But a short answer to your question, no, not really. I was extremely blessed by coming to San Diego. I transferred to San Diego in school, and I kind of like always questioned like, okay, why am I here? Like, I just came here for university, but like SA in San Diego is like just the biggest family. So there's a lot of work I think to be done in making more SA groups around the world.
Yeah. That's great. If a church planter wanted to refer people, what's the best way to do it? Someone comes to them and says, I have this addiction. How do they refer them to it?
They can go to sa.org, And from there, it says find a meeting, and it'll refer them to their local groups. If it's someplace in the world or here in the United States, it'll refer them to local meeting. And if there's none in their area, we have something called Next Meeting. I could always forward you the link. And there's our SA meetings 24/7 going on, pretty much.
Okay. That's fantastic. And it looks like to me like you couldn't just waltz in and say, hey, I'll start as a pastor at an SA group. You really have to go through it, correct? Like you kind of, you know, you can't just be the president. You got to be a member. It's like the Hair Club for Men, right? You have to come through and be, you know, someone that's worked the 12 steps. Because I'll tell you, back when I worked at rehab, that was the first question they'd ask me, you an addict? And I, you know, it was substance that we were dealing with. And I would always say, no. And they go, oh, like I couldn't help them, you know? So I think this is really important. You know, church planner, you're probably not going to be the one to waltz in there unless you are brave enough to go in there and work it yourself, should that be what you need. And that kind of leads me to my last and final question, which is for pastors. You know, like Esther, you were really straight, like, you know, money on the nose. Like, pastors are always afraid of their image, losing their position, losing their job. Like, as you're talking about this, I imagine every pastor out there's going, yeah, I can't go to that, right? And so what do you say to the pastors that are hiding? That are saying, oh, you know, I would lose everything if I went to SA. What if someone recognizes me? What if someone sees me? What do you say to that?
Well, I mean, for me, and I said I was a pastor's wife, so my husband did have to wrestle with, do I not have my camp in order? Am I going to lose my job because my wife is acting out? You know, and he had to wrestle with that too. And I left the home for 2.5 years, and then I went and lived with an affair partner. So, you know, it took him almost 6 months to like come clean with the church. He told his elders, but he kept on thinking, she's going to move back. She's going to be back, you know, and he gave me an ultimatum and that didn't work, you know. And then he was like, wow, if it's going to be a detriment of the church, if I'm not doing this right, you know, I submit to your guidance as my elders, as my board, you know, and his prayer and his like anthem song was like, even I know you're able, God, I know you can bring her back, but even if you don't, you are still good. You are still God. And that got him through it. And so, you know, but he can relate because of what we've gone through to so many, you know. And so I work with women, and when they hear my story, well, even if a pastor's wife can, you know, then it like, it just brings so much like healing, and our God is able.
Yeah, Esther, I think your story is very powerful. Because you are a pastor's wife, like nobody's immune, you know, to this addiction. And it's good. So again, like a pastor who's hiding, what do you tell them? Like, are they going to be worried about anonymity or someone saying, hey, guess who I saw at the meeting?
You know, this is a program of anonymity. What we say there stays there. And so I'm in a meeting, in my Saturday morning meeting in Hermosa Beach with a guy who used to be a missionary pastor in South America. And, you know, he said he wish he would have told me about SA back then, because he had to stop being a pastor because he was lawyering someone. And so it's just like me. I was a missionary. And so I think when a pastor says that they can't come because of someone might see him, I say that's ego.
Yeah.
And ego stands for edging God out.
Yeah. And I like this, right? Like it's even, you know, I like the idea that even sex with self, like that's, you know, if a pastor's got a problem with that, hey, go get the help you need, You know, don't feel like you got to hide that. I think it's kind of cool. And John, I think you know, right? Like John has been in one of the churches that I've planted. Pastor needs to be the most honest person in the room with who they are. It needs to come from the front. And I think that gives so much glory to the Holy Spirit, to Jesus. Like, his breastplate of righteousness is his, not mine. And also that, hey, all of us are knuckleheads. We can all do this, right? And so I love it, guys. And if you guys are out there and you're like, man, I could go remember what happens if Fight Club stays in Fight Club. That anonymity is there. You don't have to worry about it. But there's people that are just like you, who are just normal people trying to take care of this area in their life, and they can't do it alone. That's the great lie, right? Everything that's brought out into the light is what gets healed, right? That's First John classic. But guys, thanks for coming. SA, you said that it was SA.org?
Yes.
That is the best website on the planet right there, SA.org. You guys can go over there and check it out, find out what you need. And hey, I just want to give a special shout out. John, Tom, Esther, thanks for coming on again. You guys are rock stars in my book. So many people listening to this are going to get a message of hope from you. And I hope that they will display the same courage that you have modeled tonight on this podcast. You've been a gift to us. You're a gift to the church. God bless you guys. Have a good night.
Thank you.
Good night.
Amen.
Thank you. Bye.